Hello. Craig Murray was a Foreign Office high flyer who turned into a very undiplomatic diplomat. Almost as soon as he was appointed ambassador to the former Soviet Central Asian state of Uzbekistan, he began complaining about human rights abuses there. Uzbekistan was regarded as a key ally against Al-Qaeda, and the choice Craig Murray made to speak out raised uncomfortable questions about the moral compromises being made in the so-called War on Terror and about the role and responsibility of diplomacy. In the end, he had to choose between towing the line or obeying his conscience, with not just his career, but his reputation at stake. Did you, in fact, consciously make a choice? Were you aware that the course of action you wanted to take could end your career?
Yes, I was aware as soon as I started questioning the human rights situation in Uzbekistan that that was going against what the government would be wanting me to do. Then as things developed, there was a moment when I was given the choice to either take another path, which was made plain would be good for my career, or to keep doing what I was doing, with the very strong implication it would be bad for my career.
So there was a specific moment when you felt you were really at that crossroads. You could go in one direction and your extraordinarily successful Foreign Office career would continue, or you could go the other direction, obey your conscience, and it wouldn't.
Yes, there was a moment when I was fully aware that all those consequences depended on the choice I then made.
You're not the conventional Foreign Office high flyer, are you? What sort of background did you come from?
I had a state education and then went on to Dundee University and got into the Foreign Office, not really by plan. I'd never particularly wanted to be a diplomat.
What happened when you left university then?
Well, this was the mid-80s. There were 3.5 million unemployed. I sent out over 100 letters of application to employers. I only ever got 3 replies, which were refusals. And I had a first-class degree and had been president of a students' union. You can imagine what it was like for my contemporaries.
How did you end up in the Foreign Office then?
Well, I took the civil service entry exams.
Out of desperation, or were there other reasons?
No, it's because there was a girl I fancied was going to take them, and she asked me if I was going to. So I took them entirely so I could go along with her to sit the exam. And rather to my astonishment, passed. By the time I got to the final selection board, that's the stage at which you have to make the choice as to which government department you want to join. And I saw this list of government departments, things like the Department of Health and Social Security and the Inland Revenue, and I thought this would be the end of my social life. Nobody would ever want to speak to me again. And then I saw HM Diplomatic Service, and I thought that sounded really dashing and adventurous, so I opted for that one.
And what was it like when you got there?
It was interesting. There's a distinct impression of belonging to a club, and a club that rather despises everyone who's not in the club.
Because you weren't just in the Foreign Office, you were in the fast track, weren't you? And how many people in your sort of intake were fast-tracked at the time?
I think there were 22 fast-tracked. There were 2 of us who weren't Oxbridge, and I think I was the only one who was state school.
Did that make you feel an outsider right from the start?
It did. I should say it wasn't because of unkindness by people. People tried to be very kind to me, but the kindness itself often made me feel more of an outsider. I remember one very nice chap turned to me and said, and what was the high table like at Dundee? And I had no idea what he was talking about.
And how did they regard you, do you think? Just as the token prole or something a bit more than that?
People did regard me as slightly different, probably regarded me as slightly eccentric. But I think I had advantages of directness and perhaps of a wider perspective, which a rather narrow world of a Foreign Office didn't have.
Were you successful right from the start in the Foreign Office? Could you see yourself heading places right from the beginning?
I think more or less. I rather confused them by asking to go to Africa as my first posting. The fast-stream people were sent to Paris, Washington, Brussels.
They sent you to Lagos. Mm. Were you particularly regarded as idealistic?
I think I would be regarded more as hard-nosed than idealistic. I did have, you know, my own views and principles, but they didn't, if you like, get in the way of my work or of my ambition.
How did your career progress from Lagos?
After Lagos, I came back. That was the time of the first Gulf War. And I was put in charge of the FCO section dealing with analysis of intelligence on Iraqi attempts to procure weapons in the lead-up to the Gulf War, and of then taking action to prevent the taking of those weapons, which might include seizure at sea, getting foreign governments to seize weapons on their soil. It might even include interception of aircraft, that kind of thing.
What about the Foreign Office itself? Was it living up to the kind of glamour, the kind of status and lifestyle that that you sort of half glimpsed when you applied for it in the first place?
In London, most of the time, you're just any other civil servant on the train going into Charing Cross. But abroad, the accommodation, the entertaining, the servants, swimming pools, all these things add up to a lifestyle that really was quite exciting.
You were 43 when you were offered the job of UK ambassador to Uzbekistan, which is pretty young to be an ambassador. How did you feel when you found out?
I was extremely proud to have been made ambassador at such a young age. And obviously, I was hopeful it would be the first of several ambassadorships in increasingly important countries.
Did you know much about it?
I had a good historical knowledge of the region, but of modern Uzbekistan, other than, a slightly obscure part of the Soviet Union as it had been, I didn't really know a great deal.
So how did you go about approaching the job?
I left my post in Ghana in January of 2002. And in August 2002, I had to arrive in Tashkent, able to operate in Russian. I didn't speak a word of the language. And, I just immersed myself completely in language learning. I think I had 1 week being taken around Whitehall departments and told a bit about Uzbekistan.
Was it particularly borne upon you, the fact that Uzbekistan was this key ally in the so-called war on terror, and that perhaps some degree of tolerance for what is effectively a totalitarian regime was perhaps in our national interest?
It was made plain to me that Uzbekistan was regarded as an important ally in the war on terror. Human rights were mentioned hardly at all. I was told much more about the fact that it had given an air base to the United States for use in operations into Afghanistan, and about the oil and gas resources of Uzbekistan and of Central Asia.
What did you find when you got there?
Well, I'd never been in a totalitarian country before. And the sheer numbers of policemen, 40,000 uniformed police in Tashkent alone, literally three or four on every single street corner. There are almost as many non-uniformed police, secret police in Tashkent, and a whole network of informers. And people are terrified.
How did you get sucked into the human rights situation there?
Well, I decided as a matter of principle that I wanted to be much more active than ambassadors traditionally are in the Foreign Office. So I'd seen a great many ambassadors who, spent their lives in their office, seldom left it, and they left it. It was to go to a cocktail party and meet other ambassadors, where they would tell each other the same gossip and then go back and report it as though it came from a new source. And in fact, it was all circular within the diplomatic community.
You decided when you became ambassador that you weren't going to follow the same sort of policy. You were going to get right down into the nitty-gritty of the country in which you were operating. There's a certain amount of arrogance, perhaps, in that, would you say, or not?
I considered myself a great deal better than the average senior British diplomat when it came to finding out what was happening and acting on it.
That sounds quite arrogant.
No, because they were very, very bad, so you didn't have to be that good to be a great deal better.
So you decided you'd actually get out on the ground.
One of the first things that happened was a dissident trial. The Uzbek government was making a great deal of propaganda out of having caught an Al-Qaeda cell and putting them on trial. So I decided I'd actually go and look for myself. I can only compare it to film footage I've seen of Hitler's show trials, where the judge was screaming and ranting at the accused. And the accused were terrified and looked beaten and emaciated. An old man was giving evidence. He had given a written statement to police to say that two of the accused, who were his nephews, had been to Afghanistan into the training camps, were members of Al-Qaeda, and had personally met and worked with Osama bin Laden. And he was terrified like everyone else in that courtroom. But then suddenly from somewhere he seemed to find an inner strength and he said in a much stronger voice, "It's not true. They tortured my children in front of me until I signed this statement." It so happened I was actually seated about a yard from him when he said that. And you could just feel it was true when he said it. I can't explain that entirely to you because it's not entirely rational. It's partly intuitive.
This was only a matter of weeks after you'd first arrived. What did you actually do about what you'd seen at the trial?
I prepared a report to London on it, but it had a more important effect in that human rights community in Uzbekistan started to come to me with their stories. And one of the first things that came was an envelope containing photographs which a mother had taken of her dead son. He'd been a political prisoner in the Jazlik gulag. And when I saw the photos, I sent them on to the pathology department at the University of Glasgow for analysis. The pathologist's report came back and they said that his fingernails had been pulled out. He'd been beaten about the face and the neck and he died of immersion in boiling liquid. He'd been boiled alive. So I did a report based on what I'd seen at the trial and based on the case of the guy who'd been boiled alive and based on other cases that came to my attention.
And what was the Foreign Office response?
They wrote me a letter which said, Dear Ambassador, we are concerned that you are perhaps over-focused on human rights to the detriment of British interests.
What did you make of that?
I was very angry, actually. I was, you know, astonished that people could look at cases of people being boiled alive and feel that to want to do something about it would be against British interests.
Didn't the Foreign Office have a point? I mean, you're there at the taxpayers' expense to look after the interests of the United Kingdom. You're not there for Amnesty International or Human Rights Watch to campaign on human rights issues. You're there to look after our broad interests.
I think that's true. And if I'd wanted just a campaign on human rights issues, then I should have just resigned and done that. But my activist attitude extended to the other areas of an ambassador's work, not only to human rights. I would completely deny any accusation that I was neglecting other interests. My view was that they'd got the British interest wrong.
You see it as your job to decide on right or wrong, being a British ambassador there, do you?
Well, I think the British ambassador there is in a better position to decide on right and wrong than many people, on top of which our official policy had always been against torture, which, you know, an official can't just decide to change without ministerial direction. And I had no indication that this had gone to a minister. So I was trying to force this in a Whitehall way.
But weren't you doing more than that? Weren't you actually overstepping the boundary between being a civil servant or a diplomat and being a politician? I mean, this was all high-profile stuff. This wasn't you sort of subtly finding out these things and passing it on to the Foreign Office and suggesting that the politicians review what was in the nation's interest. I mean, here you are. I would imagine the more conventional kind of Foreign Office diplomat would say blundering around, very high-profile at a trial, to which you could have sent a second secretary or something like that, making speeches criticising the Uzbek government. Do you have any sympathy for the suggestion that must have been going around Whitehall that you were a bit of a bull in a china shop within a few weeks of arriving there?
I was acting forcefully in the internal battle over what the policy should be, I would quite admit. But any speech I made in Uzbekistan was cleared by the Foreign Office.
Was it suggested to you that there was a war on terror going on, that Al-Qaeda posed a particularly devastating and specific threat, and that perhaps it was not the moment to get too fastidious about how information about suspected Al-Qaeda terrorists was obtained?
That was put to me. As I was learning more and more and getting more and more evidence about torture, we were learning more and more what people were being forced to confess to under torture. People were having to confess to membership of Al-Qaeda, being in training camps in Afghanistan. Very often they were having to confess to meeting Osama bin Laden personally. Now, at the same time, as British ambassador, I was seeing the CIA intelligence coming out of Uzbekistan, which said exactly the same things. You know, we were concerned that it may be coming from the torture chambers. The American embassy response was, yes, it probably is coming from torture, but we really don't see that as a problem in the context of a war on terror.
So what did you do with that information?
I sent a top-secret telegram directly to Jack Straw.
Who was Foreign Secretary at the
time. Saying that we were getting intelligence from torture in Uzbekistan, that we should stop because this was immoral. It was illegal in terms of the United Nations Convention Against Torture.
What response did you get?
I didn't get any immediate response, to the extent that I actually repeated my telegram in January or February of 2003. And then I was summoned back to a meeting in March of 2003. And there I was told by the Foreign Office's chief legal advisor that in his legal opinion, it was not illegal for us to get intelligence from torture as long as somebody else did the torture. He said that point wasn't covered in the United Nations Convention Against Torture or in any domestic British legislation. I was also told that I was a civil servant and I should get on with my job.
The Foreign Office says that the recollections of other people involved in these meetings is not the same as yours, which is a diplomatic way of saying you're completely wrong.
It's interesting the Foreign Office say that because I wrote an account of these meetings and submitted it to the Foreign Office for clearance for publication in my book. And the Foreign Office gave me back written comments saying where they felt I was wrong about the account of this meeting. And I actually changed the account of my meeting in my book, so it now reflects the Foreign Office's changes.
What did you make of what you were told?
I was stunned. I didn't quite know what to do. I went back to Tashkent and I decided really just to kind of hang on and then take the summer to think about what to do next.
Because your whole life was in a bit of turmoil at this stage, wasn't it?
Yeah, I was going for a very, very sticky period in my marriage at the same time. I was having an affair with someone else, and was the root cause of it. But there'd been conflicts in my marriage for quite some time.
Because you had quite a colourful social life in comparison with the conventional view of ambassadors.
I have a colourful lifestyle in comparison with not only ambassadors, in comparison with most people, I think I have a colourful lifestyle, at least I try to. No, I'd always been somebody who did enjoy a party, who enjoyed a sing-song, who enjoyed good meals and fine wines and enjoyed female company.
You'd gone back to Uzbekistan, wanted to hang on in there. How difficult did that prove to be?
It was really hard. I was in a dilemma. I hated what I was doing. I felt dirty. Every time I got intelligence across my desk, which I felt probably came from some poor soul having his fingernails ripped out, it made me feel really very bad.
But this can't have been a novel situation for a British ambassador to have found themselves in over the years. Presumably there are ways of dealing with this.
But that's the key point. It was a novel situation. Prior to 9/11, we did not accept intelligence obtained by torture.
I think the official line would be that we don't accept it.
Well, that's not true. I know we accept it because I've been told it at various meetings. And certainly the main meeting in March 2003, the Foreign Office had... That meeting was minuted. I read the minute of that meeting. The Foreign Office, if they say I'm not telling the truth, I would be delighted if they published the minute of that meeting and they could show what actually was said.
Did you get to the point at which you wanted to be withdrawn from Uzbekistan?
I thought about it because I was pretty depressed. I was disenamoured of the entire Foreign Office and of British foreign policy. So my brilliant career, if you like, didn't seem to match it anymore. But I was getting somewhere in individual instances. You know, there are people who I'm sure would now be dead if I hadn't rescued them. I didn't think I could abandon them.
Besides, presumably, there were more prosaic personal consequences.
Very much so. For example, my son was at boarding school, which was paid for by the Foreign Office. I didn't have any particular alternative career. And having said that I lived an unconventional lifestyle, it was actually a very expensive lifestyle, and I had quite a lot of debts.
Nonetheless, you did tell the Foreign Office, didn't you, that you were thinking of leaving Uzbekistan? And then I think you went on holiday with your wife and children in August 2003, this would be, a year, almost exactly a year after you first arrived in Uzbekistan. What happened then?
Well, I was on holiday in Canada when I received an email from the Foreign Office asking me to come back immediately to London, next flight. So I did, and was seen in the Foreign Office personnel department by quite a junior personnel officer, who said that the decision had been made that Tashkent would be better off without me, and they were asking me to resign.
That must have been a shock.
It was. And, of course, the first thing I said was, are you asking me to resign, or are you telling me to? And the reply was, we're asking you to resign. Plainly, things aren't going well in Tashkent. There are management issues in the embassy. They then said that if I were to resign, I could go to another posting. Copenhagen was mentioned as an example. And they said quite specifically that were I to resign and go somewhere else, there would be no smear on my record, and that the view would be taken that things just didn't work out in Tashkent.
So this was the crossroads moment you were mentioning. This was the moment at which you were offered the opportunity to continue your high-flying career. Copenhagen or something like that would have been a promotion from Tashkent. It did offer you a reasonably honourable and rather attractive way out. Weren't you tempted?
I was tempted. I mean, I was in a dilemma because I had been thinking of resigning, and really I'd come quite close to it immediately before going on holiday because of sheer exhaustion and worry, and it had been a very tiring year.
But you said no.
I'd come back recharged and ready for the fight and quite keen to go back to Tashkent and get on with it. I said, no, I really don't see why I should resign. I think I'm doing a good job, and I think this is about the human rights issue.
What happened then?
Well, then he produced another piece of paper and said, well, unfortunately, we are then going to have to investigate these allegations that have been made against you. And he handed me over this sheet of paper, which contained 18 allegations against me. And the first allegation was that I'd issued visas in exchange for sex. The second was that I was an alcoholic and habitually drunk in the office. The third allegation was in effect that I'd fiddled money from the embassy by a dubious transaction, and there were 18 of them.
What did you make of that?
Well, I was completely stunned. I'm absolutely astonished. I I'm by no means the most conventional of people, as we've discussed, but I am a very honest person. These were just appalling and criminal allegations.
You then went back to Uzbekistan and these allegations were investigated?
Yeah, they said I'd got 7 days in which to resign. And they also said that I was not allowed to tell anyone of the existence of the allegations, nobody at all. Which meant I had no means of preparing a defence. And they said at the end of the 7 days, if I didn't resign, I would be withdrawn. The cards were being loaded so far against me, I cracked up. I mean, I had a complete breakdown.
What happened to you?
I was flown back from Tashkent by a doctor and went into psychiatric care in St. Thomas's Hospital, where I spent the first 10 days on suicide watch.
So how was that resolved?
I told my story to the chief psychiatrist at St. Thomas's. And when I finished, he said, you don't actually need a psychiatrist, you need a lawyer. I got Gareth Pearce, the famous lawyer, involved in my defence, which then forced the Foreign Office to actually do a real investigation into these allegations. And of the 18 allegations, 16 of them were then dropped for lack of evidence. And two of them actually went to a hearing, but then I was found not guilty of those at the hearing.
But you must have realised the game was up.
Oh, once your employer starts accusing you of criminality, then plainly your career is effectively over. Yeah.
So you went back to the UK?
I was back in the UK, where I struggled very hard to get fit. But then having been cleared of all the allegations in January of 2004, I went back to Uzbekistan to continue as ambassador.
How would you describe your physical and mental state at this stage?
Well, terrible. I was really sick. I'd developed a heart condition. Very nearly died. I was in a coma for 5 days. I was having to sleep for an hour or two at midday every day in my office. I was having difficulty walking any kind of distance. I was contending with a lot of physical problems, as well as the strain of having been through all this.
But wasn't that a good reason for piping down? But actually, you then sent another telegram, another dispatch to the Foreign Office, complaining about that MI6 was using intelligence gained from torture that had been passed on by the CIA.
Well, I did pipe down for 5 months, but then Abu Ghraib came out.
These are the pictures of torturing of Iraqi detainees by American guards.
That's right.
Well, in Iraq.
Yeah. When all those photos came out, Jack Straw made a speech in which he said, we are against torture always in any circumstances by anyone, including our allies. And the PUS, Sir Michael Jay, sent round a circular to all members of diplomatic staff saying that if anyone suspected any of our allies of torture, we should immediately report it to the Foreign Office. And my bile rose at the sheer hypocrisy of this. So I decided to set out a whole saga in one brief three-page telegram and effectively say, has it changed?
So it was a very, very outspoken telegram.
That was extremely outspoken.
And how many people did you send it to?
Probably most of our embassies in the world I copied it to, as well as quite a lot of Whitehall departments.
You wanted it to leak?
I certainly was aware that if I sent it to lots of places, somebody might well leak it.
Oh, come on. You're a particularly intelligent man who spent a career in the diplomatic service. You must have known that if you sent a telegram like that to all those addressees, that it was almost like sending it directly to The Guardian, isn't it?
Yeah, I think that's true.
Or in this case, the Financial Times, who eventually got hold of it.
The Financial Times got it in the end. It was important I didn't leak it myself, because having done what they'd done to me already, they would undoubtedly have sent me to prison for it.
But the distinction's a very minimal one, isn't it, between you actually leaking it yourself and you distributing it so widely that you're almost publishing it yourself.
There's no serious moral distinction, I agree.
Presumably, when this top-secret telegram gets published in the Financial Times, that's the end of you in Uzbekistan.
Yes, the day that telegram appeared, I happened to be in the UK at the time, waiting for clearance to go back, and I was told that was it. It would no longer be possible for me to work with the Uzbek government, so I'd been withdrawn. But they did add that I was a talented officer and they hoped I would continue in the Foreign Office.
But you didn't?
No, I decided that enough was enough. I went on to the Today programme. That led to me being suspended from the diplomatic service on a charge of bringing the Foreign Office into disrepute. The union negotiated with the Foreign Office, I would be made compulsorily redundant. And that was how I eventually left.
So they weren't particularly vengeful, were they? I mean, you weren't actually sacked. You negotiated early retirement, presumably.
Yes, I might as well admit. I left with 6 years' salary as a payoff, which was
pretty generous
at all.
How did you feel about it? Did you feel a sense of failure or a sense of triumph?
No, I felt a sense of failure. I felt, in particular, astonished that I hadn't managed to change the policy, because I still can't believe that this country now has truck with torture.
But it was not only what the government was saying then, it's what the government continues to say, that that they do not have truck with torture or the product of torture.
It's worth saying that in November of 2005, the British government lost in the House of Lords in a case in which they attempted to use evidence from torture, acknowledged as being from torture, as evidence in court.
What were the consequences of all this personally for you? How did you adjust to ordinary life?
There was an initial period of great poverty before that payoff was organised, when the salary stopped and the payoff hadn't started. I'd separated from my wife, so I didn't have a home to live in. I had to squat in the flat of a friend with my Uzbek girlfriend. And life was very difficult for her as well, because she'd been living with me, carrying out duties as my partner. And we'd been living in a residence in Tashkent, which had six bedrooms, an external swimming pool and an internal jacuzzi for eight people, as well as both a wooden sauna and a marble Turkish bath. And we're, you know, five indoor servants, seven outdoor servants. And now we were squatting in a two-bedroom flat in the East End, eating stale bread from a garage, toasted, because we couldn't afford anything else.
What's life like now?
I make a living, such as it is, as a writer. We live very modestly indeed in a two-bedroom flat in Shepherd's Bush, but I think we're enjoying life.
But you could have been Britain's ambassador in who knows where. Does that at any time make you regret, not necessarily taking a stand, but the way that you took a stand?
I think back on my career, and I think of things I did achieve. For example, I negotiated in difficult and dangerous circumstances a peace treaty with the rebels in Sierra Leone, and I no longer have the chance to do that kind of remarkable thing. And yes, I miss that. But there's one thing I do know, which is that I discovered something about myself. I have ultimate moral standards of my own, and that there's a line I won't cross, even for obvious personal advantage. And I feel comfortable with that, and I feel happier with myself than I did before.
And you continue to think you made the right choice?
I'm certain I made the right choice.
Craig Murray, thanks very much indeed.
Thank you.